David Goodrich worked for many years in climate science. He was at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He served as a director of the UN Global Climate Observing System in Geneva, Switzerland. And then he retired as head of NOAA's Climate Observations and Monitoring Programme. In his retirement, he decided to take up his bicycle, and he cycled across the US, leaving Delaware and arriving in Oregon. But climate was still on his mind, and he spoke with folks all along the way about climate. And he talks about his experience in his new book, A Hole in the Wind, A Climate Scientist's Bicycle Journey Across the United States. He's going to be speaking at the Boulder Bookstore on Thursday at 7:30 p.m. But I'm delighted to have him in the studio. Good morning.
Great to be here.
Where did the idea to bicycle across the country come from? I mean, was it separate from your work as a climate scientist? And at some point, did the two ideas merge?
For many years, I commuted into work. And gradually, I got this idea that, there are people that ride long distances that do bicycle tours. And I did an early tour out west in the year 2000, where I was trying to follow the route of the Nez Perce from Idaho into Montana. And that was the first long ride that I did, and I enjoyed it. And then in the back of my mind, before getting ready for retirement, it's like, I could go all the way across. And then it sort of became almost an obsession, if you will.
Getting back to your career as a climate scientist, when you were in Switzerland, when you were working in Europe, what is the discourse around climate change there? And is it as divisive as we often have here, where when we mention climate change, we have so many people who are basically are denying it? Well, what compared that to what's going on in Europe?
The discussion is much less loud, and there's a far greater acceptance of human-induced climate change. It's not a grand debate. There are people talking more about, about sustainable lifestyles. You also have things are on a smaller scale. People are driving smaller cars, living in smaller spaces, though I don't think anyone could argue they have a lower standard of living. But it's there. You don't see, people posing climate change as a great debate, one side versus the other.
We'll talk about what's happening at a national, at a policy level in just a moment, and the role climate change denial is playing there. But just in terms of the ordinary people that you met on your journey from the East Coast to the West Coast, before you embarked on that, were you expecting to hear as much people denying climate change as you ultimately ended up meeting?
I've listened to talk radio and Fox News and things, so I knew there's clearly a lot of questions, a lot of debate around it. But I think in a lot of ways, climate is something that people don't necessarily want to discuss. That was almost the surprise, that people would take that you could talk about it, about the drought, you could talk about the local weather, you could talk about on the coast about tidal flooding. But once you got, once you mentioned the C word, it's like, oh, you're getting into politics, and people kind of shut down about it. There was one place where in Kansas where I was checking in, and the lady was asking, why are you doing this ride? This was at a motel. And I said, I'm looking at climate change across the country. And it's like, and she said, do you know Al Gore? I said, actually, no. No, I've heard him speak before. But the light sort of went on, because he is, on the right, a very divisive figure. It's like, no, this isn't about Al Gore. But in a lot of ways, it sort of got, the topic got changed as I would go along.
Well, as a climate scientist, you're used to looking and observing and seeing things. So what did you see that emphasized for you, or that you were able to directly attribute to climate change on your journey? Because when you're going by bicycle, you have much more of an opportunity to really interact with the landscape, never mind the people, but just the landscape, and to see what's happening. Were you yourself able to see things that you could say, that's climate change?
There's one of the most prominent cases was right here near Boulder in the Front Range. When I came across Kansas, Eastern Colorado, I went up to Fort Collins and I took the Poudre Canyon Road up to Cameron Pass. And, you know, it pretty much beat me to death. I was carrying a lot of weight, but I got up to the pass at 10-2, I think. And I had heard about mountain pine beetle, but I kind of looked around. It's like, no, it's not like the forests are in trouble. It's like the forests are dead. And then it's like, oh yeah, that's the mountain pine beetle. And it used to be that once upon a time, repeated 20 below winters very few would be able to survive over the winters, but it's been a long time up high since the winters had been that cold, and the beetles have gone crazy. It's sort of the empire of the beetle up there. And the idea that this spreads for 40 million acres up the Rockies into British Columbia is a pretty huge deal. There's one other case near where I live at on the East Coast. There's an island I visited near where I started called Fowler Beach, where there's, you know, it's a barrier island, but there's not much left of it anymore. I went out there to take a look, and you can see a guardrail hanging out in the air. It's like, this is where the road used to be. And you can see the remains of a tower. It was actually a World War II observation tower that plainly was sitting on dry land during World War II. So there's been a tremendous amount of erosion on the East Coast. And I studied this in my research. The sea level rise is quite dramatic in Chesapeake Bay. So you can find places in Chesapeake Bay where there's a place called Sharp's Island Light, where there's a lighthouse that is leaning and just sticking out of the water, and there used to be an island there and not all that long ago, at the turn of the 20th century, there was a hotel and a resort on that island, and it's all gone now.
Did you talk to people in that area about climate change? Because you mentioned the woman in Kansas who mm-hmm. really saw it as a political issue, and when you mentioned yep. the C word, as you, mm-hmm. We refer to it, they totally shut down. But in areas where you're visibly seeing and the people there are experiencing the impact of climate change, what's their reaction to it?
In Delaware, I talked to a woman who was a homeowner there. I said, well, what are you seeing about sea level rise? And she said, well, I don't know about sea level rise, but boy, the flooding's really getting to be a problem. And then basically she went on a riff about how expensive the flood insurance is getting to be. And, you know, you don't necessarily want to proselytize, but you sort of say, you definitely have a problem if you're this close to the water. But I think there's a, you know, you look at what happens, you know, what's happened in the last 5-10 years, and that's sort of the part of your experience. And for her, it's like, wow, we're getting more and more of these floods. You don't necessarily want to connect it to sea level rise, but it's pretty clear that that's what's happened.
So with all the people that you met across your journey, were there any surprises for you as someone who spent their career working in climate science about how we're communicating climate change in terms of people either receiving that messaging, particularly when there seems to be like a cognitive dissonance almost, where people are living through something, but they're denying that it's actually happening? Did you see any opportunities to change how we're messaging this or change how we're talking about this to maybe get those people to listen?
Well, I think part of the problem is that climate change gets pitched as catastrophe, and that's not necessarily the best way to communicate. There are clearly going to be some big impacts of climate change, but I think a more positive message can make a difference. I guess the example I would make is that riding across Kansas, where there are lots of folks who aren't necessarily buying into climate change, but the difference between when I first rode across in 2011 and when we drove back across last year is in the wind farms. Wind farms have gone crazy across the central part of the U.S. So you don't necessarily have, you can say, okay, I don't buy climate change, but okay, what about renewable energy? And the idea that, you know, wind energy has exploded in Kansas, in Iowa, in Oklahoma. Texas is the biggest producer of wind energy in the country. So you don't necessarily have to accept it to be part of the solution. And I think a lot of people are getting there. The other thing that I find encouraging as far as the messaging goes is that you can you see where Tesla, I'm not sure if they're still, their market cap is, there was above that of General Motors for a time, and I'm not sure if they're still up there or not. But regardless, it's like, okay, the market thinks that renewable energy, electric cars, solar energy is the way of the future. And so I find that quite encouraging as well.
What's the connection between the people that you met, the lady in Kansas who shuts down the conversation when you mentioned the C word, climate, you know, the lady in Delaware who's experiencing flooding but not connecting that to climate change, and then what we're seeing now at a federal level when we have essentially climate change deniers in government, and what's the connection between the two, and what role does media have to play in that?
I have to think, you know, just from the election returns, that a lot of the folks in the center of the country were voting for President Trump in this last election, and so you wouldn't be surprised if these people don't think that climate change is a very important thing. But at the same time, I mean there's from my perspective, there are an awful lot of problems with what's going on at the federal level and with the backing away from climate. I mean, the idea that we're going to make the United States a fossil fuel superpower, it's like, okay, aren't we sort of buying into last century's energy? But at the same time, I look at what's going on the international side, as in, the world is not equivalent to the U.S. In particular, the Europeans and the Chinese have a great deal to say about what happens globally on climate. And then also on the state and local level, it's very encouraging to see what states have done, led by California and Governor Brown. Where I come from in Maryland banned hydraulic fracking. This last year, and my county, Montgomery County, passed a resolution divesting county pension funds from fossil fuels. So it's like, okay, the what's going on the federal level is a problem. I don't want to minimize that, but it's not necessarily the whole story.
And in terms of then the role of the media, because where are people getting their, I don't want to say information, almost misinformation, people who are living through the impact of climate change but aren't connecting that to the broader picture of climate change? Is that because they're not getting information or accurate information, or they're getting climate change denial information from the media they're consuming?
Well, I think there's a... we tend to be siloed in where we get our information from, and that's been an increasing tendency of just about everybody. I think a lot of the folks in the in places like Kansas, rural Indiana, are getting their information from talk radio, from Fox News and such. I'll give an example. I overheard a conversation where I was stopping in out of the rain in Indiana. A couple of guys, pretty clearly farmers, were talking to each other about how heavy the rains had been. And one of them said, the rains, you know, that must be that global warming thing. And he said, oh, yeah, get yourself a government grant. There's a lot of money in that climate change stuff. And I just, you know, you kind of grind your teeth. And but you're also in a place in the middle of, you know, you don't know these people and you're in the middle of nowhere. But that's clearly part of the tune that you hear on talk radio, that it is all a grand conspiracy of, you know, greedy scientists to make up something so they can get money from the government. It's like, I really know that personally not to be the case.
How do you think we need to change then the conversation about all of this with the people that you've met and then your background working on the other side as a climate scientist and trying to convey that information? Now, has your mindset changed a little bit having met the people that you've met?
Well, I think we need to look at it. First of all, there are an awful lot of people that view on across the board view conservation as a positive thing. The idea of stewardship of the planet from a religious side as a positive thing. So I think there are ways that you can turn the conversation, and also the idea that there is a big transformation in our energy economy that is taking place and that needs to take place. I mean, we need to keep roughly 80% of the fossil fuels that we know about in the ground in order to stay within a 2°C warming. And that's actually a huge opportunity. One of the biggest growth jobs around is wind technicians. So there, we've got a rewiring of the energy system that's happening, and we can get people involved in that. And in a lot of ways, that's happening. You know, the biggest new wind farm projects, I'm not sure if it's in Oklahoma or in Wyoming. Neither one of those places are necessarily strongholds of people who are buying into human-induced climate change, but they are definitely part of that energy transition.
What's next for you now? Because that's such a transformative experience to take that much time to cycle across the country, meet the people that you meet. You know, you spent your career in climate change science and climate science. What's next for you?
I have a another book that I've been working on. I rode a route of the Underground Railroad from Mississippi up to Lake Erie, and I kept bumping into historical figures along the way. Josiah Henson, who was the model for Uncle Tom and Uncle Tom's Cabin, was an escaped slave who grew up in my hometown of Rockville, Maryland, and I followed his route for quite a ways. So I'm working on a book about the Underground Railroad, but I also want to get back to climate issues. One of the things that I'm toying around in my mind is to go take a ride from Fort McMurray up in basically where the tar sands are being developed, across the plains in Canada and down to Williston, South Dakota, to perhaps through Standing Rock and down to Rapid City, South Dakota, down the middle of the country. I'm thinking about that one. I usually do a big ride every year, and that's on my list.
This is a huge bicycling community here, people who do it for leisure. A lot of people do it as part of their commute or mm-hmm. as their commute. What is it about seeing the world at the pace of how quickly you can cycle a bike that can really change how you look at the natural environment, but also in terms of the access then that you get to people that you don't necessarily get if you're whizzing by at 70 miles an hour?
Well, particularly when on tour solo, you can, it's very easy to meet people and to chat them up. You're probably the least intimidating person that they could come up with. I mean, if you're a crook, you got the slowest getaway vehicle there is. But I find on a bike that one of the things I really enjoy on tour when I'm out, when I'm outside of cities, which is most of the time, is what you hear. I mean, you can't hear the hiss that a wheat field makes in the wind from a car. I remember going across Wyoming and hearing something that sounded like a crow, and it's like there are no birds anywhere around. It's sagebrush to the horizon, and then I realized, you know, I picked out the antelope, and that's the alert sound that an antelope makes. So it was kind of, I mean, it was fun that way, and particularly in terms of what you can do on a tour. I came into, when I rode into Boulder, I was in a bad way. My rear stays on the bike rack had both split, and my rear rack, I was literally holding on by bungee cords. And I remember going into University Cycles down on Pearl Street, and I said, you know, I really need some help on this, and I'm going to try and get on the road tomorrow. And I see all guys have got all these bikes. It's one of the busiest bike shops in the country. And I say, is there any way that you could help me? And he said, come back in an hour. And I came back in an hour. It was fixed. It was like, this is crazy. That it's just like, okay, you're a tourist. We'll move you up. So,
and of course, a zero carbon footprint attached with the cycling.
I usually get about 50 miles to the pancake.
Well, David Goodrich's new book is called A Hole in the Wind, A Climate Scientist's Bicycle Journey Across the United States. And he speaks about it at the Boulder Bookstore on Thursday evening at 7:30. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Maeve.